You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight on Right on Radio, Liz Olds talks with Noel Obiora. He has a law degree from the University of Texas and has also studied at King's College in London and the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. Currently, he lives in Northern California with his family and works as a senior public utilities counsel for the state of California. He's an avid soccer fan and is a documentary film enthusiast.
And I'm Annie Harview. In the last part of the hour, Ian Gramlisk talks with Bill Straczynski about his memoir, Care Under Fire. Straczynski details his time as a combat medic in the Vietnam War, thrusting the reader squarely into moments of terror during firefights, the exhaustion of endless patrols, the anguish of losing friends, and the intimate bonds created during times of desperate need. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Yes, I am.
Oh, great, great. This is Noel Obiora. And he is the author of A Past That Breathes. Welcome. Why don't we start with an intro to the book, and do you have a reading prepared?
I do.
Okay, why don't you tell us a little bit about the book and then do the reading.
Sure. The book is a murder mystery about a young woman who died in her apartment in Los Angeles. And the police bring the case to trial. And the two lawyers who are trying the murder mystery are trying their murder cases for the first time and have romantic interest in each other. So they're struggling with the social system at the time, which was doing the OJ trial, the murder mystery in front of them, and the relationship they're supposed to have with each other. Just trying to find harmony in both... in the midst of the racial and political tensions of Los Angeles during the OJ trial, while trying to solve a racially sensitive murder mystery that stays engaging to the end.
Mm-hmm.
So let me read. I'm starting on page 72. Let me read a piece of it for you.
Great.
Amy had hoped to steal into a corner of the club with a glass of vodka mixed with grapefruit juice on ice and observed the scene. The only other Caucasian that Amy could see besides herself and Nada was a burly bartender with a baby face and thick brown hair. Nada took off her jacket and approached the bartender. Amy looked around, trying to smile without looking directly at the man. Her eyes met some of the woman's gazes, and though she could not make out their expressions, she felt judged as if she had trespassed into one of the few places left for them to be themselves, without someone like her being there to judge them. Many of the women wore tight dresses, stiletto heels, and black pantyhose. The heavier the woman, the higher the heels and the tighter the dresses, it seemed. A few wore jeans, loose skirts, and t-shirts, a flower pattern dress, or a white pantsuit that must have seemed elegant at the wedding for which it was purchased. Most of the men seemed tall and big-boned, in tight-fitting t-shirts over broad chests and bulging biceps, but always a jacket. A taller and bigger man seemed to prefer baggy pants with their suits. "What will it be?" the bartender asked Nader. Amy was standing tightly behind Nader as the bartender spoke, when she noticed someone's hand come over her shoulder from behind and rest on it. As she tried to turn, expecting the man had mistakenly rested his hand on her, the hand squeezed her shoulder. Amy froze. Her shoulders hunched up to her ears and her spine stiffened to the audacity of a familiarity she could not imagine having with anyone in this club. Then she heard his voice. "Amy Wilson, what on earth are you doing here?" Nader turned before Amy could, with a grin on the verge of laughter. Amy held Nader's shoulders and turned her back around to face the bartender. Then Amy turned to see Kenneth in a white shirt and black slacks, looking as young as she remembered him 6 years prior, a smile affixed on his face, his eyes on hers. His hair was neatly low-cut. "Kenneth," Amy said, but Nader quickly interrupted her. "What would you like to drink?" Nader asked. "A greyhound," Kenneth said. "Not you, her," Nader said, pointing to Amy. I'm telling you what you would like. Amy nodded to Nada and turned her around again before Nada could say another word. Excuse me, the ghost of Kenneth Brown, what brings you to life? Kenneth did not answer, not with words. They gazed at each other briefly, then embraced. The bartender retreated with Nada's order, and Nada turned around to face Kenneth and Amy. And that's where I stopped the reading.
Great, thanks. This is Noel Obiara, and his book is A Past That Breathes, the murder mystery that's set in Los Angeles during the upheavals about Rodney King and O.J. Simpson. But first I want to talk a little bit about your life history. Talk about coming to America at age 17 from Nigeria. You must have had a lot of feelings about the differences between Nigeria and the United States. Why don't you talk about your experiences?
Sure. I initially came here for college. I immediately after high school, I was shipped over to the United States to go to college in Connecticut. And I was 17 at the time. And all I knew about the United States, of course, were, you know, the pop culture, the music, the movies, a few of the books, being raised in a British colony. But I didn't quite know anything much else about life in the United States. You know, it's just what you see in the media, the movies and the music is what we knew. So coming to the U.S. and then coming to Connecticut, not having experienced snow before, was my first experience. I think what happens then is, you know, being one, a foreigner, and secondly, seeing that you're here for a purpose and you're leaving, you know, you're just not here to stay, because my objective was primarily to go to college and go back to Nigeria. One tends to see themselves as removed from the social issues and not, you know, not really a part of it. You know, acknowledging they exist and knowing they exist, I'm feeling being exposed to it, but feeling like you're just in transition, you're going to leave. And then there's the pressure to assimilate in the larger culture that you come into, and while being part of the, you know, the smaller culture that's in it. And so all that was what I grew up with in Connecticut in my late teens. But after a few years in the U.S., there was a coup and after counter coup in Nigeria, and I went on to law school and ended up staying. And through the process of staying and experiencing being Black in America, I think I began to experience and see a lot of the social issues that inspired this book. I actually think that the being in Los Angeles during the Rodney King period, it was a period not unlike, you know, the past year that we've seen, or the past few years that we've seen. Mm-hmm. There was Rodney King, there was Latasha Harlin, there were all those, and then there were the riots, and then there was O.J. Simpson. I think that period really educated me, or, you know, made me understand myself in the society more than anything. And that was the period I tried to capture in this book.
Now, you went to law school in Texas, correct? And
yes,
you,
University of Texas.
Worked as a lawyer in Los Angeles for a while. And I'm wondering, you spoke about it a little bit, but I'm wondering what kind of racism and inequality did you experience both in Texas and then as you were working in the LA court system?
So in Texas, I was mostly immersed in school. I barely left the 40-acre confines of the University of Texas system. So I wasn't really exposed much to it in Texas. I mean, in the sense that I was invisible to some, that may have been reflected in my stay there. But I didn't experience any so much overtly in school there. And in the court system in Los Angeles, it was different. It was an eye opener. As I mentioned, I came here at 17, And when I would go to court representing, you know, in criminal cases, usually when you go to a trial or when you go to a hearing, they do the arraignments. You know, they bring in the people who need to plead in or who've already, you know, settled their cases or pled their cases, and they bring them in and then they take their pleas and then before they go into the motions. And I would recall sitting there as a young man and wondering and just watching this young men, very young men, just march in and out on issues that that made me often wonder how in the world I escaped the state. You know, how was I not marched into one of these? Because just talking to a policeman anyhow could result to in an insubordination that will bring you into a misdemeanor, that will give you a record that the next time you have a case, that becomes a record that makes your next case really much worse. And so I saw that a lot. I saw that in how the officers investigated my cases in my interaction with the police officers, you know, but I was careful not to, well, not careful, careful doesn't begin to explain it, but I was cautious not to let that escalate into anything more for myself. And oftentimes when they find out I'm a lawyer, they give me my space.
And I'm wondering if the case in A Pass That Breeze is based on a case that you are aware of, or did it come completely from your mind?
Yeah, the case itself, the particular plot of finding this woman, you know, sort of dead, and then the murder mystery around it, the case itself came from all in my mind. But everything around it, the processes, the motions that were held in court, the issues around the contracts, everything that happened in that court came from my practice. I would say that I have done 95% of the things that the lawyers did in that court with specificity, specifically to even the way they did it. Even the way they argued some of the cases came from my trials, and I just found a way to bring them together in this particular one plot.
The book includes the difficulties faced by two lawyers who are becoming an interracial couple. They have not really decided or figured that out yet. Is that something that you either experienced yourself or you knew people who were dealing with it? And also, they're on opposite sides of a very serious case that has a lot of tension. And it's just a very interesting conflation of things, and I'm wondering if you have known people who've gone through that, or if perhaps you even went through it yourself.
No, I wouldn't. I haven't gone well in terms of the being involved with a lawyer on the opposing side. No, I haven't gone through it myself. In terms of the interracial relationships and the trust influences that come into it, I've known people who've been through it. I think what I was really trying to capture there is how our lives are not isolated from the cases we try. You know, how the influences that we wake up with, the effects that we're, the thing that we're dealing with socially, have specific ramifications in the cases we try. You know, you give in this responsibility as well pointed out, of a very important murder trial, and you're also struggling with the resources you don't have to fight it and the limits of your own experience to do it. But more than all those things, more than the resources, the limits of your experience, the hard work you're putting into it, what could really throw that case off would be what side of the bed you wake up on. Because at the end of the day, it is your mind, your person, your physical person, and your health that has to be intact in order for you to go into the courtroom and do a good job. It is still, in a sense, a performance that you have to be healthy to put up. And in this relationship, things happen. You know, things happen where you wonder if you're of the right mind. Or you wonder if things are distracting you from what you're supposed. People wonder if things are distracting you from what you're supposed to be focused on. On that issue also, the particular case decided, there was a case decided where the court pointed out what two lawyers on opposite sides of the criminal case should do if they are seeing each other. That case is an actual case. It's actually a case called People v. Jackson in California, and I researched it and used it in this proceeding. So that's an actual thing that has happened in case law, and the court have pretty much laid out how two lawyers involved in that type of situation should address it. Well, I was more coming out of, I was mostly coming from the point of this notion that we bring our lives into the things and the roles we play, whether it's in law, whether it's in police work, or whether it's in the office. Our lives influence what we do, and oftentimes when that life is hammered with social issues and injustices, it adds a whole lot more stress to it than if it didn't. So,
how old were you during the O.J. Simpson trial, and how did it affect you in thinking about law, inequalities, different kinds of things that, and were you living in the U.S. or Nigeria?
During the O.J. Simpson trial?
Yes.
Oh, I was a lawyer in Los Angeles. That's what motivated. That was one of the inspirations for the case. I was a lawyer practicing in Los Angeles at the time. I was probably 26, 27. I don't know. I can't do the math quickly in my head now. And I just started my practice shortly after law school, and was really struggling with getting it off the ground. And most of my clients couldn't afford their attorney's fees, and a lot of them were facing a lot of issues in courts that needed that probably shouldn't have been put against them in that way. And yeah, so that was my experience. I think what frustrated me in that period was just the complete focus on the O.J. Simpson trial and how, it just dominated everything around me. Meanwhile, there were some real lives and real issues that were going on with people who, can't afford the dream team, but a system that doesn't really give them that due. And nobody's seen, it seems like the media wasn't really too interested in that. And I was in Los Angeles. I was practicing law, and a lot of the things in the book, in terms of the interaction between the lawyers, in terms of the issues, some of the issues in the case, came from my practice in that period.
How would you like your book to enter or perhaps spark conversations about racial inequality and injustice and the Black Lives Matter movement? What kinds of things would you like your book to bring out in those situations?
Oh, thank you for that. I would want the book to keep a path of discussion open, always make us understand that the differences we have is often not it's that we can learn from each other, so to speak. I don't want to infer ignorance in one way or on one side or the other, but that we can learn from each other. We often a lot of our differences come from differences of interpretation, a lack of some depth of knowledge as to the issues the other side is facing, which, of course, you don't know as much as the side that's experiencing it. I would like the book to say that we can find some form of harmony in the midst of racial and politically divisive tensions, regardless of what the issue is between us, in front of us, And frankly, what the kids in the Black Lives Matter movement have been doing, has been encouraging. I mean, that they've found the strength to stand up and speak and essentially assert their, insist on being heard, is something that really wasn't there in the 1990s when the riots in Los Angeles happened. Granted, social media has helped their efforts to associate and come together, but I find what they're doing frankly impressive. And you find that in their being able to speak that way, they are able to reach more people of different backgrounds and diversity who share their opinions and believe in their cause to come together and fight for it. I would hope that my book is trying to say that. You would see in the two characters that at some point, even though they don't agree on the O.J. Simpson case itself, at some point they don't agree and one says to me, please don't tell me O.J.'s this or that. And the other one says, yes, I will tell you that. And they have this discussion about why they disagree. And it's not that they disagree on the fundamental wrong of the racial injustice, but it's often the interpretation of what that wrong, of how that wrong is being received. And I think that's what, you know, we need to stop first and acknowledge the wrong, rather than always say, okay, yeah, it's wrong, but how about this, but that? Let's keep the buts aside. Let's talk about the wrong, because that's at the heart of what's causing these issues.
I'm curious if you are watching the Olympics, I'm curious how you feel about the she's not discus, shot put, the young shot put player who won the silver medal and protested by crossing her arms over her head during the anthem and talked about intersectionality as being is something that was important to her. Are you familiar with that, or do you have a feeling about that?
I didn't watch that, but I've heard of it. And I do have a feeling about that. It wasn't that long ago that Colin Kaepernick in of the 49ers knelt down,
yes,
to protest the anthems. I would hope that we've learned from the reactions and that people had to Colin to be able to accept this young woman's expression of her views under the circumstances. I don't think it takes away from the national anthem per se.
But one
would have to really walk in her shoes to be able to appreciate knowing fully well that she's going to be attacked, knowing fully well that she's going to come under these criticisms and still feeling like this was something she needed to do. I think it's something I would rather respect than criticize. And I think, you know, despite everything that went with Colin kneeling during the national anthem, we have now, I'm a huge soccer fan, and before every European Premier League soccer game, the players kneel down. They don't do it during the national anthem, but they kneel down to acknowledge or to push for racial unity. And it's something that I think they wanted to do in response to the treatment that Colin got. And I hope that we don't go the way a lot of people went when Kaepernick did with this young woman when Kaepernick started kneeling down. We don't have to agree with it, but one has to respect what she's come through and what she's trying to express.
Yes, thank you for that. We don't have a whole lot of time left. I'm wondering, what is next for you in terms of your writing? Are you going to write another mystery?
I would hope there's another mystery in my future, but I've always come to writing not in terms of genres, but in terms of things that really move me and inspire me, and things that make me want to put out a discussion out there, and make me want to tell a story that makes people think and that makes people understand the world, a world I've been able to experience or a world I've been able to come from, in a way that they may not have understood it from my perspective before. So I do think there's another murder mystery in my future, but I don't think it's what I'm going to do next. I'd like to try my hands on other narratives and genres before that.
Well, thank you so much. We're out of time. I wish we had more time. I have many questions written down here to ask you, but time flies when you're having fun. So we've been speaking with Noel Bierra, author of A Past That Breathes, and thank you very much for your thoughtful answers, and we appreciate you being on Right on Radio.
Thank you so much, Liz. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Have a good night.
You too.
I hate snakes. Why is it so hot? Does it ever stop raining? How many days left in the country? Will I be brave? Will I make mom and dad proud? Are we really patriots? Lord, don't let me fall asleep on my watch. Lord, don't let me screw up. Why do firefights seem like organized chaos and lots of noise? Did someone yell medic? Where's my morphine pack? Where the hell's that dust off? Why are night ambush patrols full of terror and frequent mayhem? Remember to pull the pin before you throw. B-52 bombs sure make big holes in the ground. A second chest wound really does suck. Thank God for petroleum-caused battle bandages. When it came to sutures, the baseball stitch was my favorite. Wow, my training didn't prepare me for this. Once a blue spader, always a blue spader. Duty first. I'm sorting through my experiences during the tour of Vietnam and tour of duty. I prepared a list of expressions above, all of which will be immediately recognized by those who served. Each reference communicates some aspect of my story in concise terms, covering 366 days in a combat zone. These declarations run the gauntlet of my experiences and summarize my feelings. As they say, I survived my time in hell. I gathered wisdom and learned to understand what it means to be courageous. I felt the burdensome pain of worry and the full effects of heartache. I did and experience things that most young adults can't begin to envision. Perhaps they should not.
Wow, it's very moving. You were listening there to Bill Straczynski reading from his memoir, Vietnam memoir, Care Under Fire. Bill was born in 1946 and grew up on the east side of St. Paul in Minnesota. He served in the U.S. Army in 67 to 1969. Upon his honorable discharge, Straczynski returned to college and earned a degree in political science in 1972. He was appointed by the governor to the position of deputy commissioner and eventually the commissioner of the State Department of Administration. In 1980, he left state government to establish his own government relations consulting firm and still continues to represent clients in the state government as a state government lobbyist. Straczynski has trained as a combat medic in the army, which is what this book is about, where he earned numerous awards, including 3 Bronze Stars for Valor and the Combat Medical Badge. Thanks for doing that, Bill.
You're welcome.
He resides with his wife, Kirsten, in Scandia, Minnesota. Welcome to Right on Radio, Bill.
Thank you. Happy to be here to share my story.
That was so well read.
Thank you.
That moved me quite a bit, as you can probably tell.
Yeah, it's an important expression that really dig to the soul of what it's like to serve a tour in combat and all the various aspects and things you deal with and have to deal with and deal with them for the rest of your life.
Now, amongst some of the things that you've kind of listed to me as what feel important to you. Part of writing this book, you know, we often ask our authors why they wrote a book, but here you started off apparently with a speech that you gave to the Minnesota Ambulance Association, EMTs, paramedics. Tell us how that related and how that got this whole process moving.
Well, it's a very interesting circumstance, actually. I spent the last 49 years of my life in government activities, working for government early in my career, and then later on as a government affairs consultant, lobbyist. A few years back, I was asked by the Minnesota Ambulance Association to give a speech, to be a keynote speaker during their Stars of Life Awards banquet. That banquet is once a year they recognize EMTs and paramedics throughout the state for life-saving activities. I initially thought they wanted me to talk about how things worked at the Capitol. And when they said, no, we want you to talk about your experiences as a combat medic. We heard that about you. I said, let me think about that for a while. Well, I thought about it for a couple of weeks. And I said to myself, if anybody understands my experiences and what it's like to have to make some tough calls or some tough decisions, it's those people, the EMTs and the paramedics. They deal with this stuff all the time. They deal with heartache. And so I agreed to do that. And through that process, I spent a fair amount of time putting my thoughts on paper so I could deliver a good speech. And so I had a lot of materials prepared. Interestingly enough, that day I gave my speech, and you could have heard a pin drop. I was really amazed because they related directly to what I was doing, and I related directly to what they do every day. And at the end of my speech, I got a standing ovation, and they said, welcome home. And they gave me one of the life-saving awards, and that just brought tears to my eyes. It was a very powerful moment.
Wow.
So then I went back and I started thinking about that. Well, if it moved that group, and it was good therapy for me to write the speech and to present this information, to tell my story after all of these years, there's a part of it. I decided that we might as well put it together, put a book together, and continue to get my story out there. Mm. I believe those are really important. The young people today need to understand our history about that. But most importantly, I wanted to address my family, dear family. You want to know who I really am, how I became to who I am today? Let me share with you my early perspective.
Had you kept some of that information from your family for a while?
It was, that's a good question, Ian. Typically, the issues never come up. You know, they know dad or grandpa was in the service and was in the army and there was a Vietnam War, and that's about it. People are hesitant to bring that stuff up, I think. But more and more today, there's more legitimacy about discussing some of these things because so many of us suppressed these comments and thoughts for many, many, many years. It was not a good time to come back to America in 1969 from a combat zone to an angry public that was very antagonistic against the war in Vietnam. So that was really hard to do. So we suppressed a lot of those feelings in our conversations and our thinking for many, many years. And you'd ask any Vietnam veteran to tell you the same thing. We were not welcomed home, so mm-hmm. why go there? And so I think that's kind of why. Now after the experiences we have with the modern military in Afghanistan and Iraq and the welcoming home that these people got, and remembering how good a job they did and were thankful for their service to protect America, to keep America free, it really paved the way and made it easier for us Vietnam veterans to now start talking about our stories and sharing that information. It's powerful today. More and more people genuinely are interested in what happened then.
I'm getting deja vu because I almost heard exactly the same conversation with a couple of other Vietnam vets, Tim O'Brien and Carl Melentis, who sat in that seat and talked to me about these same things, and both of them good friends of the show. And, you know, it's all very emotional for both of them. Came back, I think, with various levels of PTSD, as did you.
Yeah, I suffer from PTSD, and as do a lot of EMTs, paramedics, nurses, and doctors who are on the front line today doing a lot of the same kind of traumatic things. I have recollections. I think about things that I did every day. I think about people I treated, I think about, did I do the right thing? Mm. Could I have done more?
You're still doing that.
Still doing that. And so there's remorse there. Mm. I've reconciled all of that, and certainly in my heart and my mind. But it's still there. And interesting enough, a lot of older veterans who were Vietnam veterans are now at home, according to the VA, and in my own research, they sit at home. They've already raised a family. They've worked their entire life. They've been very, very busy. Now they're retired, and now they're reflecting upon their experiences. They were just serving the service in the Vietnam era, perhaps. Mm. And there's a lot of heartache there. They've never processed this material, this information, the things they observed and went through. And there's 23 suicides a day in this country from veterans. Mm. And many of those are older veterans who should have processed this stuff years ago. Mm. I've gotten a lot of feedback from my book and emails and letters from people who say the same thing, that thank you, I should have processed it. I was fortunate to process some of my issues mm. with a group of friends who were Vietnam veterans as well over the last 50 years. So that's been helpful in my case. But yeah, it's a lot to go through.
Do you think having been trained as a doc, as you were called in the platoon, was that in any way an aid to recovery? Already, I mean, having had that training about how to heal,
yeah.
did it create some kind of advantage for you in the healing process?
It's a very interesting question. I have never thought about it quite that way. I can't say that my training prepared me for that. But the characteristics of a medic, if you look at modern websites for the U.S. Army, will tell you that medics are typically people who are empathetic. They can make decisions. They can think and analyze circumstances. And they're risk takers.
Mm.
Maybe it's the empathy side of all of that that does help in some of that.
You need some self-empathy, wouldn't you?
Yep.
Yeah.
I had 10 weeks of training. And as a combat medic, and I went to Vietnam, and I was assigned immediately to the infantry. I never got out of the field, and I never saw a hospital my entire tour of duty in Vietnam. My job was to go on patrol to take care of those souls and the soldiers in my charge and try and save their lives when the bad things happen.
Well, it's a horrific situation, and you write about it with a lot of empathy and care. And, of course, this is non-fiction. We've seen people like Tim O'Brien write about this in a fictional way. And he's been on the show a number of times with going off to Cachiato, the things they carried, and in the Lake of the Woods, and those stories where he really brings alive, really terrible situations which you talk about almost in exactly the same way, realistically.
Yeah.
And I just can't imagine having to wake up in the morning and think about that. I never had to have that experience. I was lucky.
Yeah. Well, I have everything in perspective in my life, and particularly with my experiences as a young man. But it is something you can't escape. I think it's interesting that in war there are no unwounded soldiers. And in war, you deal with things forever. I was told that I had to give 2 years of my life to Uncle Sam. I was drafted in late 1966, so I had to give him 2 years. Well, that was not true. I've been giving Uncle Sam my soul, my thinking for over 52 years, and that's the tough part about it. But because so many older wounded veterans, PTSD, other disabilities, there's a lot of us out there. We're still dealing with these same kinds of things. At least the government now recognizes that and is providing some kind of assistance and support for any kind of situation you might think you have today. And the same is true for modern military soldiers.
Well, food for thought. This is Ian Graham-Leask here, and I'm interviewing Bill Straczynski about his book, Care Under Fire. So with that in mind, is there some advice you would give to younger soldiers, people that have recently been in Afghanistan and places like that? Has it changed? The same thing?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. I thought about that a little bit when I met with Lieutenant Colonel Stars, who's the current battalion commander of the 26th Infantry Regiment, which I served with in Vietnam many years ago. My first battalion commander was Alexander Haig, by the way.
Oh, wow.
He went on to become somebody important in the military and certainly to our country.
He certainly did.
But I was talking to him about that, Lieutenant Colonel Stars, just last fall when I was at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, doing a little speaking about this book. And I said, Colonel, I cannot relate to the technology you have today. I cannot relate to the weaponology. I cannot relate to the strategies you deploy. But I can relate to the heartache and the difficulty of making decisions, particularly decisions that will impact you as a leader of the regiment or the battalion, and all your soldiers in your charge, those particularly experienced combat. I can relate to all of that. And then that was the common bond that certainly binds all military soldiers and sailors and everybody else in the military.
And my understanding is that the survival rate now has changed dramatically. It's much higher.
Yeah, it is much higher today. They primarily because they wear body armor, and they're not doing the same kinds of patrols that we do in the same kinds of hostile territories. So it's very dangerous to go into Fallujah, for example, and you know, house-to-house searches. They're better protected that way with the equipment. We didn't have that. And in fact, they learned a lot from Vietnam. Vietnam, interestingly enough, was the first time medics were embedded with the infantry. They never were before, prior to that. So then the reason was it was designed to try and save lives.
They, in World War II, they were not embedded, or Korea?
No. What happened in World War II in Korea, certainly, medics were up near the front, near the battle lines, but it was a different kind of war. It was fought a different way. And they wore red crosses on their helmets and whatever, and didn't carry weapons. That worked pretty well. But when we got to Vietnam, because we operated primarily in a lot of small unit groups, at the platoon or squad size or company size operations, they wanted the medic embedded with every unit that went on patrol. So every time a squad of 10 went out, a medic went out as well. And there were bounties on our heads, so we didn't wear the red crosses, and we didn't wear anything that distinguished us and would help us stand out to the enemy.
And of course, you carried a weapon.
And I carried a weapon. I carried an M16, 45, a couple of hand grenades, Claymore mine for nighttime ambush patrols, and I carried my aid bag, which weighed about 12 pounds. That's the only way you could tell that I was different from the other soldiers, because I carried an aid bag. And I have to tell you that being with the soldiers, didn't know that was the first time we were actually embedded with the infantry, but the relationship that we developed with each individual soldier in our unit was phenomenal. They looked to the medic to help take care of them should the unimaginable happen, and then I looked to them to protect me when the unimaginable happened, because I'm the one that had to go out to the call of medic and typically out to the flank or something and help bring that person back so I could render care and then evacuate them eventually. So I explained that kind of a particular situation. It's a wonderful bond that exists to this day between medics and military people. No matter who you are, you talk to generals about the role of medics, and they'll give you a big high five and thumbs up about the role we played interacting with the soldiers. And I always said, thought about it, that I said, during that time, I was always afraid to go into combat. It is not any fun, and it is nasty and mean. People get hurt and people die. I was always afraid to go into combat. But at least I had my brothers.
Yeah,
that made a tremendous difference to all
of
us.
I loved the way you wrote that in there. That was so good. It was just really hit home. Fantastic. And how do you feel about those guys now? Are a lot of them still around? I mean, I know you lost a lot of people, but are you still in touch with some of the survivors?
You know, actually, I'm not in touch with anybody that I actually served with. I do belong to the 1st Infantry Division Society, and I do belong to the 26th Infantry Regiment for our battalion association as well. And we get together every year or two in an association meeting or a conference or a convention. Actually, I'll be in Las Vegas next week with the 26th
That's right,
Regiment.
I heard about that.
And so that's helpful for it. But we don't sit around and tell lots of detailed war stories, but we have that commonality, that kind of bond that brings you together. And we do share about how the families are going, how's it going for you, and various things. And that's a wonderful relationship there.
So, and this is a tough one maybe, and you don't have to answer if it's uncomfortable, but tell me about your dreams that associate with this.
Yeah, I don't mind talking about it because I think that's always good therapy. And actually, when I got the book complete, I sat back and I cried and I said, wow, that was pretty therapeutic as well for me.
I don't know why.
I mean, I don't have nightmares per se anymore, but every day I think about these things, and frequently they do visit you at night. And what happens is you witness and you see and think about particular situations, and wishing the outcome again could be different, but you can't change the outcome. It's always, no matter how many times you think about it, the end result is always the same. They made it, it's suffered severe injuries, became permanently disabled veteran, or they died. So you can't help, but you can't change that circumstance. But what you can do is compartmentalize it and learn how to deal with it and move on with your life. And I think I got advice one time from a soldier after my first killed in action was at nighttime on an ambush patrol. And that man actually saved my life. And I always had remorse because I was never able to save his life. Oh. He died. And he's the one that saw the enemy machine gun and told me to just hit the ground and do all of that stuff. That one really hit me hard.
And then he was killed.
Mm-hmm. He actually, he saw, we were on a patrol getting ready to move into our ambush site that night. And going across an open field, which we shouldn't have been doing, but we were being led by a new lieutenant. And he saw the enemy machine gun set up near a village behind a berm, on top of the berm. And he said, "Hit it, Doc." And I was just as close to him as you and I are, about 4 feet apart. And a burst of that machine gun came and hit in front of us, threw dirt in my face. The ricochets did, and the ricochets went up over my head. But one of the ricochets caught him, hit him in the upper shoulder, near the head. But a bullet went down, did traumatic and damage inside, and that's what he just succumbed to his injuries later on. But that moment was really hard, you know. I gave him morphine. I did everything I could. I lay on top of him trying to hold him down because we're still being attacked, and he was trying to get up. I mean, it was very, very traumatic and trying to deal with that. So you can't help but think about those kinds of things. But you do compartmentalize them, and you do have to move forward. After that incident, I was really distraught. And there was an old sergeant in charge of the platoon, of the medical battalion. And he finally sat me down. He says, "Bill, I was in World War II. Doc, I got to tell you, it's like this." He says, "First of all, he wasn't your brother. He might have been because he wore the uniform, but he wasn't your physical brother. You didn't shoot him, and you did the best you could under some pretty shitty circumstances, actually. You did the best you could. And I'm going to tell you, you just started your tour of duty. You've got 11 months to go, and you better get your stuff together, or you're not going to be worth a damn to all those other soldiers who are counting on you." Mm. And that was like an epiphany after I heard that, his comments. I mean, I really needed it. I needed somebody to help me process that immediately, and that's how I've conducted the rest of my life. I've dealt with many tough situations, as we all have.
And does that enter your dreams, all of that whole situation?
Yeah, I think about that circumstance quite a bit. Yeah.
It's funny, another question about stories. And it's interesting, you say it took a while for the stories to start coming out, and I grew up with that as a baby boomer. I'm a little bit younger than you, and I didn't have to go to Vietnam. But my dad was on the Murmansk runs in the Second World War and got sunk. And he would wake up in the middle of the night screaming. And sometimes he couldn't remember what the dream was. And then one day he actually did. And the Stukas were coming down at him. And sometimes there were Stukas, and sometimes there were seagulls. And of course, the destroyer got sunk, and all the men on the bridge were killed, including his captain, who was decapitated. And my dad just happened to be out back getting a cup of tea, and he supervised the evacuation of the ship. Didn't even get his feet wet. They were straight onto the boat, and whatever. And he told me that story eventually. I'll be darned, I dream about that. Now, is it possible that trauma of this kind gets passed on to children?
I suppose if you've shared enough insights into your past life about those circumstances with your children, and they haven't had too young an age, and you haven't had a chance to process it yourself or talk it through extensively with your parent, your dad, I think you probably could.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of talk, there's a lot of things that I've read in the past, people on the show talking about how trauma reaches down through the generations, especially with, you know, people that are involved in the Holocaust and things like that. So I wonder with you if that's one of the reasons you didn't talk about it much, because there's an instinctual sense of, you know, being a medic to not infect other people with what had happened to you.
We didn't talk about the war. I don't mind talking to groups and talking to veterans, other veterans about it who were there. That's very therapeutic when we do that. So, but that's about it.
Well, we're going to end on that somber note, but there's nothing somber about this wonderful book that you've written here, Care Under Fire, Bill Straczynski. You are a man. Thank you so much for doing what you did. And thank you so much for writing this book. And thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. And I just want to say that I'm really glad I found you in my life, because you helped me, as your professional skills and development helped me get this story out. And it feels good. And I winning this national award, it was phenomenal for me. I appreciate the accolades and the good wishes. But those awards actually belong to every Vietnam veteran who hasn't gotten their story out, because I'm just one of those many people. There's lots of stories out there that need to be told.
That's beautiful, Bill. Thank you so much for being on the show and saying that.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And now this